want to show you a general overview of some of the data we're getting. This is just examples. We're not doing statistics on this or anything. But here you can see the larvae, the surface sterilized egg, non-sterile egg, control site wood, oviposition site wood, control site bark, and oviposition site bark. You can just generally see that all of these communities represented by the different fragments you see are very different in all of these samples. But we can pull out some patterns. So we do see some bacteria that are only associated with the tree, which would be expected. So you see fragments in all of the wood or bark samples, but not in the insect samples. But also we see some fragments or some taxa that are found in the oviposition site, the egg, and the larvae. So you see the fragment in the two oviposition samples, but not in the control wood samples. And then they also come up in the larvae and egg samples. So these are bacteria that are likely following the hypothesis of the inoculation of the oviposition site, because we don't see them in the environment, but they show up in the oviposition site. And then they're carried over to the larval stage inside of the egg to the larvae and then passed on. So overall, we did 65 rhesus samples over all of the treatments and identified over 85 unique bacteria taxa based on fragment length. We sequenced those fragments so we know what these bacteria are down to family or genus level. And in order to organize this, we performed a cluster analysis. So this just creates a tree, and the tree is based on the microbial community present. So things that are close within the tree have similar communities, things that are far away on the tree have very different communities. So the questions that we can answer are, looking at this tree, are there unique microbial communities associated with the different treatments? So if our treatments cluster together on the tree, that means that those treatments have unique communities. And also, we can go back to the sequence data and look at what taxa are environmentally derived, picked up from the tree itself, or vertically transmitted, passed on from adult to larva. So here's our cluster analysis. Each of these different colors just represents the major branches of the tree. And you can see that, in fact, our samples do cluster. I have it so you can actually see it. So the top one here is the larvae samples, followed by the sterile egg, non-sterile egg, oviposition site, and then the environmental samples. And what's interesting is all of the insect samples cluster together in the top of the tree, the environmental samples at the bottom, and the oviposition site, which would be kind of an in-between between an insect and an environmental sample, because it gets inputs from both, kind of falls between the two. Also, you can see the number of taxa that we identified in each of these samples. And we see a much more diverse community in the environmental samples than we do in the insect samples. And I'm going to present now just on some of the bacteria that we see in these samples. I'm not going to go through all 85, so I'm just picking the most abundant bacteria and those that most describe the different branching patterns that we see. So samples that we see in all of the tree, in all of the samples, are likely environmentally derived and then maintained in the insect gut. So the one that best describes this pattern is a Xanthomonas species. But we can also look at this top branch of the tree, which includes all of the insect samples as well as oviposition site samples. So this would be this oviposition-derived bacteria, those that are being deposited by the adult. And we see two species that are pretty abundant in these samples, Lactobacillus and Cornibacterium. Finally, if we look in those that are just within the sterile egg, so this removes any bacteria from the surface of the egg and the larvae, these would be vertically transmitted through the egg itself. And we see two common gut bacteria species, Enterococcus and Curtobacterium. So there is some vertical transmission, it seems, through the egg itself, or within the egg. So overall, we see a consistent microbial community associated with the ALB larvae. And we can see specific taxa that are vertically transmitted from adult, or in this case, oviposition site, to larvae. There also have many environmentally derived taxa found with the ALB gut. And our future work we'd like to do is identify the communities associated with the adults, which we're working on now, we just didn't have time to present it today, and look how the community changes as the larvae transitions from the phloem tissue into the inner wood, where the wood is, where there are much less sugars and that sorts of things in the wood. So likely it's really going to have to rely on cellulose for its major sugar sources. And we're going to correlate this with wood degrading activity that we've already done in our lab. So I'd like to thank the members of my lab. This is our Christmas party photo and our funding sources, and would be glad to take any questions. Thanks. Right.
Are there any examples in nature that support that
hypothesis? So some of the earlier work done by Kukor and Martin out of University of Michigan in the 80s showed that lower cerambycid species actually pick up a fungal species in the environment. So they pick up this fungal species and the fungal enzymes in the wood. But these cerambycids are feeding on decaying wood. So what we are likely seeing is kind of a transition from picking up species from the environment to actually having some that are you know, vertically transmitted within this insect. And we also see a fungal species that I didn't talk about today, but it seems to be more intimately associated with the insect than what is found in lower cerambycids. Yeah?
Have you looked at the enzymatic profiles just published on those different bacteria that you found in your different clusters? Do you know anything about if any of them can digest cellulose?
We have a collaboration with the Department of Energy, and we're actually doing an ALB gut metagenome sequencing project. So all of the bacteria species in the gut are having their complete genome sequence, and we're paralleling that with a transcriptome project where we're looking at both beetle and microbial-derived transcriptomes. So that'll be able to answer the question of who's doing what, where, when, why, and how. Yeah?
We don't have any more time.
Oh, sorry. Thanks.
That we have come up with is that the extracts from the soldier heads influence the nestmate cat differentiation. And we're going to answer this hypothesis, or try to answer this hypothesis, using three main objectives. First, we're going to test the effects the extracts from the soldier heads in bioassays. Then we're through past research and GC mass spec, we're going to identify the chemicals that are found within these soldier head extracts. And then we're going to look at the influence that these soldier head chemicals have on the termite nestmate gene expression patterns. So throughout all of my research, I used the main model bioassay that was developed in 2003. And they consist of a dish bioassay that has a plastic petri dish that has treated paper within the dish that the termites live on. We put 15 individual termites in this dish, and we monitor pre-soldier formation, cast differentiation, and mortality every 5 days for 25 days. So in my first experiment, I wanted to test the combination of these soldier head chemicals plus juvenile hormone. So over here on the y-axis, we have the cumulative pre-soldier formation at day 25, and then across the bottom, I have my number of different control or different treatments. And as you can see, in the acetone control, the methylene chloride control, and soldier head chemicals by themselves, we saw no induction of pre-soldiers. But when we look at juvenile hormone, we see some pre-soldier formation. But when we have this combination of juvenile hormone plus these soldier head chemicals, we see a synergistic effect and an increase in pre-soldier formation. So the next thing we wanted to try to identify is what some of these chemicals were. And through a number of GC and mass spec and mostly past research, these are our GC traces. So we see on the soldier, we see two major peaks. And these two major peaks have been shown through past research to have been identified as gamma-catenine and its aldehyde version. And interestingly, we also assayed the pine that the individuals were feeding on, and we saw none of these similar peaks. So we know that the soldiers are making these chemicals by themselves. So the next thing we wanted to do was we wanted to compare the expression of key developmental genes of individuals treated with these different chemicals. And with the whole idea of this is that we identify key gene networks responsible for cast differentiation. And I did this by using two bioassays with identical treatments. My treatments were control, juvenile hormone, soldier head extract, juvenile hormone plus soldier extract, and then a treatment of live soldiers. And in my first bioassay, we just did exactly what I've done in the past, where we monitor pre-soldier and mortality through 25 days. But in my second bioassay, we did a destructive sampling where we collected individuals at day 0, 1, 5, and 10, and then did quantitative real PCR to look at the gene expression profiles. So the results from my bioassay, number one, to look at the pre-soldier formation, were similar to the ones that I've done in the past, where over here, once again, we have the percent cumulative pre-soldier formation, and along the bottom, I have my treatments. And once again, we see some pre-soldier formation in juvenile hormone, but when we add juvenile hormone plus soldier head extract, we see this synergistic effect. So then we look at the gene expression profiles, and this is the results from gene expression profiles at day one. And this is where at the very beginning of analyzing this data, but in this data you can see this is a heat map showing the gene expression profiles across my different treatments. So across the top I have different treatments, the same treatments that I've had, and then each one of these bars represents the gene expression profile for one specific gene, where red represents the gene upregulation, while blue represents gene downregulation. And what we're able to do is we're able to cluster these genes and to compare expression profiles. So we're able to see which genes are flowing with each other. But if we specifically go in and we look at some of these genes individually, so for example, we look at a transcription factor, a bicaudal gene, we'll see that it's pretty much upregulated in most of the treatments. This is relative expression, but we see a dramatic increase with this juvenile hormone plus soldier head extract. If we look at another gene, for example, a vitellogenin gene, we see the exact opposite. We see, once again I have my treatments on the bottom, we see a high expression with the soldier head extract and a high expression with the live soldiers, but a down regulation when we have the juvenile hormone plus the soldier head extract. So because we see this high expression with just the soldier head extract and with the live soldiers, we can see that and show that soldiers are having an effect on nestmate gene expression. So the next thing we want to do, well, first of all, the next thing we want to do is we want to look at all these genes more carefully and identify their role in the Cas differentiation process. So in conclusion, we've seen that extracts from the soldier head synergistically work with juvenile hormone to maximize this worker to pre-soldier differentiation. We were able to identify suites of genes that were either upregulated or downregulated in response to these different treatments. And the overall goal was to help understand the role that soldiers are playing in the colony itself. So showing that they're not just for defense only, showing that they are having an effect on nestmate Cas differentiation. And finally, one of the goals of this research is to identify and develop new termiticides, mostly termite Cas disruption termiticides that are probably going to be highly termite specific. So with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you guys have about the research that I've been doing. Dr. Henderson?
Are you suggesting that soldiers somehow are stimulating the production of more soldiers?
No. Yes. So far, that's that these chemicals from the soldiers. You know, we don't know if the chemicals are being released from the individuals or the chemicals are being sequestered from the colony. We don't know that for sure, but through the gene expression profiles, we're hopefully trying to identify what's specifically going on within the nestmates. Dr. Borowski?
How would they release these chemicals from the head and influence
Well, actually, on top of the soldier termite head, there is a pore that, you know, and we haven't looked exactly what's underneath the pore, but in other termites, there are, you know, that's where most of the chemicals, the defensive chemicals, come from the individuals, are out of the pore of the head. So. They could be rubbing it, or this could be one of the theories is that this process is like if a soldier gets killed, you know, the chemicals are released from the head, and then it could stimulate other individuals to turn into soldiers. So kind of like a replacement program. Not that we have noticed. We haven't noticed that they're volatile. Dr. Henderson?
How many head extracts did you have to apply
We also we've done a dose response where, you know, we've gone from down all the way down to 0.5 head extracts all the way up to 4, and we see kind of a peak around two heads. But you know, more research needs to be done to specifically nail down, you know, a dose response.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have CCD win and you left it blank. You know you have CCD when the government offers money for dead colonies. And that's true. In Canada, they began in two provinces, they began to offer money for colonies that had been lost, and all of a sudden people came out of the woodwork that they had dying colonies. So that's one thing. The next, Marla Spivak told us that basically we shouldn't be able to keep our bees alive with all the things that she said. The one thing she did point out was that bees are often in agricultural environments foraging in a desert. They're out there working just one or two crops. and they bring that material back, and it may or may not be nutritious. On top of that, you then heard from Chris Mullen from Penn State about even if they're bringing back this monoculture thing, that it could be contaminated. So the food may be nutritionally less valuable, and yet it also could be contaminated with various pesticides and stuff. And then May Barenbaum actually gave a very encouraging talk in which she identified 8 genes that looked like they separated, you know, some of our CCD and non-CCD colonies. So that was very encouraging. And that goes with Colin's talk here, where we have a new system brought into bear on colony health issues, this IVDS technology, which again could offer the potential to find unknown viruses and stuff. Diana Cox Foster touched on the IAPV story, and also on just the fact that we are seeing a lot of different lineages within those bees, as far as a lot of different lineages within the IAPV story and viruses. Ian Seller brought quite a bit of information and a lot of new hypotheses is what's going on. But the viral integration into the honeybee genome and offering resistance to the bees themselves, I think, is very encouraging. And then Steve Shepherd told us that, in fact, yes, we do have bottlenecks, and we are working with a very distinct and diminishing genetic pool within our honeybee populations. And more so, I took from Steve that with the loss of the feral bees, we actually have lost quite a bit in the way of genetic diversity. And again, I've already touched on Colin Henderson's talk. So anyway, I've been very encouraged by the talk so far. And I'm just going to briefly run through a little bit of things that I would like to highlight or emphasize. I'm not going to say very much about CCD and the symptomology and things. I am going to talk a little bit about some of the misconceptions and things, and a little bit about where we're going with some of the research. I think May Barenbaum touched on it, but we're focused here on honeybee health, but in fact the National Academy of Sciences concluded that all pollinators are in decline, but they used honeybees as a poster child for that publication, because honeybees are the one species of bee that we have good consistent data with over time. And they pointed out that the honeybee population in the U.S. has declined from about 5 million managed colonies to about 2.5 million managed colonies. And I'll show that in the graph here in just a second. In almond pollination alone, we use 1.2 million colonies in there. So we're using about half of our managed bees in almonds. And so this, I could almost stop the talk here, but unfortunately, I won't. If we go from 5 million managed colonies down to 2.5 million managed colonies in that time period from the 40s to 2006, and we're using half of those bees in almonds, a number of those colonies are not mobile. In other words, we're using most of our managed commercial bees in almonds alone. And what happens when we have a 30% loss, which is what we estimate last year, we lost about 30% of the bees. Not all CCD, and you'll see that in a minute. We lost 30% of our bees last year, not all due to CCD, but if we have no buffer left in the system to almost meet our pollination needs. So we have not had crop failures and things yet, but we're pushing an uphill battle with increasing pollination demands in almonds and other crops, and we're stuck at this 2.5 million managed colonies. Bees have ongoing problems that are preventing us from increasing those numbers. So to me, that really is the take-home message. In honeybees, the declines have gone on for a number of reasons. We did introduce parasitic mites, and that's kept us low. But we can't afford to add CCD if it's something new. We can't afford to add that on top of the problems that we already had within the industry and still continue to meet the pollination demands. Marla Spivak said if we had the one graph, we'd show all the arrows going to California. Well, there it is. And that just indicates that I think it's much higher. It's about 1.2 million colonies currently, but it's the vast majority of the managed colonies, of the managed mobile commercial colonies. The other half of our managed colonies are in people's backyards, and they're not mobile. So we rely on honeybees, and they are mobile, but with that mobility comes some stress. If you think about a honeybee colony, and you think about the bees themselves, the queen, the workers there, the wax comb, the honey, the pollen, and the brood, that colony itself is actually a nice smorgasbord out in the environment. There is no wonder that there's all these different organisms trying to take advantage of that. It has everything that a lot of these organisms need to grow and replicate. So the bees themselves are constantly on the defensive. And we've seen from the honeybee genome work, that in fact bees themselves have very few defenses. In fact, they rely probably more on behavior and things like propolis as a defensive mechanism than they do on their own immune system. Symptoms of CCD, we've heard it, rapid loss of worker bees, excessive brood in the colony. So we're seeing this loss of worker bee population over a very short time window, and that's the unusual part. And when we sample those colonies and we look for things like varroa mite levels, we look for Nosema levels, we don't see a consistent picture, and yet we see this loss of worker bee population. So where have the bees gone? Why have they died? Why are they off in the woods somewhere? The media has really had a field day with this particular portion of the CCD story. The fact that the bees are disappearing. Well, the reality of it is, in bee health, for a bee to die away from the colony is advantageous. It's taking the pathogen with it. So in sac brood and other diseases that we know in honeybees, it's advantageous, and the worker is supposed to die away from the colony. It breaks the transmission cycle. So that's not unusual. In the myth part, if you listen to the media, you'd think that every problem in the bee industry is all CCD, and that's simply not true. And I think Marla pointed out, or maybe Dennis Van Engelsdorf, that bees, not all deaths in the U.S. are caused by CCD. And so the first thing we do when we go out and to investigate bee losses like this is to try to rule out the obvious causes. The Apiary Inspectors of America this past year, and there was a number of surveys, it was run by Bee Alert Technologies, but the Apiary Inspectors of America is the data I'll show here, and they estimated that we lost 30% of all our colonies last year, of honeybee colonies, and that in a normal year, and this coincides with what Dennis said earlier, a normal year you'd lose 17% of those colonies. Does that mean that only 13% of our colony losses are due to CCD? Maybe that's true. Maybe that's somewhat accurate. What's 13%? What, I mean, that's not a huge problem. It's a huge problem when you add 13% onto the 17 to 20% that you already had. That's when it becomes a problem. And then of those people reporting CCD within their operation, the losses were much higher. So within individual operations, we saw much higher losses. I'm just going to return to this media and the perception of CCD. If you look at what the media thinks about why we're losing colonies or what the problems are in the beekeeping industry, they knew about parasitic mites, but they think all of our other losses are due to CCD. In other words, CCD is the flavor of the month or the year or whatever, and that's what's impacting our bees. So losses, if you try to attribute them to different causes, the media would say that CCD is our number one problem. If you ask the beekeeper what their perception is, the beekeeper might say, well, 50% of his or her problems are caused by parasitic mites. And they're probably, maybe they're getting there. Mites are certainly underlying, and varroa mite in particular, are certainly underlying a lot of our problems. The beekeeper might then go on to say, well, yeah, and in certain cases, I've got a CCD problem. I've got other factors. Other factors could be a very big group. It could be Nosema. It could be pesticide exposure. It could be poor nutrition. It could be migratory stress or whatever. And then the last little bit of the top of the box is that they made a management mistake. Occasionally, there's going to be a management problem that's going to impact the overall survival. The reality, perhaps, is somewhere in between all of that. And what I'd like you to take home from this is that parasitic mites probably are underlying a lot of our problems, and they're at the base of all these pillars. We have all these existing management and other problems, the Nosemas, the tracheal mites, and everything else, and CCD could be just a combination of those other factors coming together in a new way, or it still could be a new pathogen, a novel pathogen, interacting with some of those existing factors. So to me, I don't want anyone to lose track of the fact that we in the beekeeping industry have a number of ongoing problems, and that CCD is something perhaps new, but it certainly is on top.